employer. The only way clear is to do your job. Right, Jeb?
Pryor reluctantly agreed. He asked Fry, "Who are these guys you've let into my mill?"
Fry shot a panicked look toward Nate when the grip tightened on his ear.
"I don't know their names, I really don't. Part of the arrangement is I walk away from the burner when they show up and don't come back until they're gone. I've heard their voices, but I've never seen them face to face."
"You've been letting them use my burner as a crematorium," Pryor said. "What's wrong with you?"
"They pay in cash."
Pryor's face reddened, and he narrowed his eyes.
"You've earned whatever's coming to you, Wiley."
As he said it, he glanced toward Nate.
"Don't even think about running," Nate said to Fry. "Just show up for work like you always do."
"What then?"
Fry asked. Nate shrugged.
"We'll figure that out."
Nate and Pryor left Fry on the floor. Pryor kept the handgun. Pryor walked stiff-legged toward his truck. He said to Nate,
"I'm not real comfortable with what's going on around here and what went on in there."
"It could have been a lot worse," Nate said. "I let him keep his ears."
He tossed the trout club into the back of his vehicle.
"Personnel is the hardest part of running a business," Pryor said. "I could use a guy like you at the mill."
"Thanks, but I've got a business of my own."
Then,
"Keep your cell phone on tonight. We might need you."
Joe called back just as Nate was turning the ignition on in his SUV.
"You actually called me on my phone?" Joe said.
"Yes. You need to get the hell back over here as fast as you can,"
Nate said.
"It'll happen tonight."
"What will happen?"
"I already told you,"
Nate said, and punched off. Chapter 30 Sheridan pulled the snowmobile trailer in her truck up the old two-track road into the mountains as the frozen trees closed in on her from both sides. She'd remembered to check in with Mark Gordon on the satellite phone after the first hour.
"Did you find him?"
he'd asked. "I'm not there yet," she'd replied. She was concerned that the sky hadn't lightened up much and that the forest was still muted in shadow. It looked and felt like more snow was on the way, and she wanted to get to Lance's cabin and back out before a new storm hit. She wondered how many times her dad had been in the same situation before, high in the mountains alone as a storm moved in. She thought, a lot. It was obvious that the road she was on had been tracked within the last few days, and she presumed it was from Lance's truck. Very few recreational snowmobilers favored that area of the snowy range because there were scores of better trails and more spectacular rides above encampment in the Sierra Madres and on Highway 230 farther south. Sheridan rounded a corner with lodgepole pines tight to both sides and came upon a cow moose standing in the middle of the road. The moose was wedge-shaped and jet-black and long-legged for moving easily through deep snow, but instead of moving on, she just stood there staring. Finally, Sheridan tapped her brakes and honked her horn. The cow ambled into the timber and vanished so quickly, it was as if she were never there. A shiny brown pile of moose pellets steamed in the snow to prove she had been. "Now you're going to find out why we call him Lance Romance."
What did that mean? Were they just messing with her head?
Lance's old red Ford F-150 pickup was parked where it should have been, in a wide alcove in the trees. His snowmobile trailer was attached to the rear bumper and his machine was gone. Sheridan parked next to Lance's Ford and climbed out and checked the cab of his truck. It was unlocked, as always.
He'd left his keys under the driver's side floor mat next to his cowboy boots. No doubt he'd exchanged his everyday boots for a pair of snowmobile packs before he left for his cabin. There was nothing else inside the cab that was unusual or suggested that anything strange had happened. The only thing in the bed of his pickup was a light dusting of snow from the night before and a few old empty beer bottles that always rattled around when he drove it. She backed the Titan off the trailer and secured the pack she'd assembled into the tub with bungee cords. Sheridan pulled on a snowmobile suit that was too large and a helmet that was a size too big. She wished she had spent a few more seconds in the activity center garage making sure she got the right fit. Before she took the narrow trail that would lead to his cabin, she lashed the 30-30 in its scabbard to the side of her snow machine. She was somewhat assured that he'd be at the end of her journey in one way or another because the trail was packed down into the light powder snow by a previous machine. In the summer, it was a 20-minute ride through thick timber to Lance's cabin on an ATV. Snowmobiles traveled at approximately the same rate of speed. She took it slower than that because she'd never driven there by herself in the winter. That and the oversized helmet kept twisting to the side, and she had to adjust it to see out the clear plastic shield. It was through the slightly foggy face shield that she saw the curl of smoke from the chimney of Lance's cabin and his snowmobile parked out front. The snow around the structure had been trampled down by boots. She breathed a sigh of relief. The cabin was small and made of logs with a green metal roof. She'd heard Lance complain that he wished the roof had been pitched steeper, because sometimes 2 or 3 feet of snow gathered on top and threatened to collapse the trusses. Like most people who owned high mountain cabins, Lance spent his free days in the summer rechinking the logs and getting it in shape to last the coming winter. 2 cords of fresh-cut and split pine were lined up in a kind of wall against the southern tree line. She could see a well-worn path from the door of the cabin to the stack of fuel, and another to an outhouse half-buried in snow. But what was he still doing inside? Had he lost track of the days of the week? Sheridan looped around the small clearing in front of the cabin, so the tub was close to the front door before turning the engine off. That would make it easier for her to load him if he was hurt or sick. She stood up on the sideboards of the snowmobile and slid her visor back. It was suddenly still without the high whine and vibration of the motor. The sky had darkened even further, and there was the anticipatory stillness in the trees that usually signaled coming snow. Lance? Nothing. Lance! Flickering yellow light from his kerosene lantern played on the frosted glass of the window next to the door. Her boots squeaked in the packed snow as she approached the cabin. Lance! As she reached for the rusted iron door handle, the door swung out, and she had to step back so it wouldn't hit her.
Oh, thank God you're here,
Kate Shelford Longdon said in her clipped British accent. She was without makeup and wearing jeans, ankle-high slippers, and an oversized fuzzy sweater.
Lance is in bad shape, and he needs to get to hospital. I tried to take him there myself, but I couldn't get his snowmobile started.
Sheridan closed her eyes for a moment, then reopened them. Kate was still there.
Come inside, quickly, Kate said. You're letting the cold in.
Sheridan rocked back, then shoved Kate with both hands so hard that Kate fell over backward and struck her face on the tabletop on the way down. Sheridan stormed into the cabin and slammed the door behind her. Lance was on the iron-framed bed, naked from the waist down, except for his underwear. A white shard of thigh bone poked out from the discolored flesh of his upper leg. His body gleamed with sweat from a fever. He was unconscious, and his mouth gaped open.
What happened to him?
Sheridan asked Kate, who was scuttling backward across the floor using her feet to propel her. She raised both of her hands to her face, and blood trickled out from between her fingers from her broken nose.
He was scooping the snow off the roof when he slipped and fell early this morning, Kate said.
Her voice was muffled from behind the hands.
I went outside and found him like that.
Sheridan looked around the inside of Lance's cabin. She recognized it, of course, but what struck her was the woman's touch that wasn't there the last time. Instead of the sets of antlers and old fur traps on the walls, there were nice curtains, a clean floor, plastic flowers in a vase on the table, an actual tablecloth. Kate had been there a while. Sheridan said,
We need to get him out of here so he can recover, so I can kill him myself.
Kate's eyes widened even farther. She said,
I'm staying here, if you don't mind, but please get him to hospital.
We say the hospital, lady, Sheridan said, and you're coming with me.
To back up her words, Sheridan took a quick step toward Kate, and Kate recoiled. Point taken. Although Sheridan had a dozen rage-fueled questions to ask of Kate, they couldn't talk. The whine of the snowmobile was too loud. After binding a thick compress from the first aid kit to Lance's leg to prevent further bleeding, he moaned while Sheridan wrapped it tight. Kate helped her half-carry and half-drag him toward the door. While Sheridan lashed him tight into the tub, she looked around for a sign of the silver 2017 Jeep Cherokee with Colorado rental plates hidden in the trees behind Lance's cabin. It wasn't there. Kate sat behind Sheridan on the machine and grasped her around her waist to hold on. As she drove back through the trees, Sheridan frequently looked down at the pair of British arms locked on her beneath her breast and grimaced as if they were radioactive. She also shot glances back at Lance wrapped in blankets and lashed in the tub. He'd moaned and stirred while they did it, but he hadn't woken up, even though Sheridan had jostled him around more than necessary. She considered taking a turn extra wide and letting the tub thump against the trunks of trees, but she didn't. With Lance still unconscious in the back seat of the pickup, Sheridan retraced her route down the two-track back to the state highway. She'd left the snowmobile and trailer at the trailhead to retrieve later. Sheridan drove as recklessly as she dared to get out of the mountains, while Kate was obviously scared for her life. She hung on to the safety handle above the passenger window with one hand and braced herself against the dashboard with the other. Her broken nose was red and swollen, although the bleeding had largely stopped. Sheridan didn't speak until they turned onto the blacktop of the highway. After taking the truck out of four-wheel drive, she said,
Do you know how many people have been looking for you? Do you even care?
I haven't been following the news, Kate said.
You created an international incident.
That wasn't my intention, Kate said defensively.
What the hell was your intention?
Kate relaxed a little and let go of the handle above her head. She placed both of her hands on her lap and stared at them. She said,
Until I got on the ranch, I'd forgotten what it was like to simply unplug from the modern world, to go through the days not looking at my phone, not answering constant emails and texts, not looking at Facebook or Twitter. It was like I was feeling myself slow down in real time. A weight was lifted. I'd no idea what kind of pressure I was under until it started to melt away.
Sheridan looked over but didn't respond.
You've no idea what it's like to be in a job like mine, Kate said. The stress is incredible, and there are hundreds of people, even people who you think are your friends, who are just waiting for you to say the wrong thing or make the wrong move, especially in the age of social media when you're in the public eye. Everyone wants you to fail in the most spectacular way possible, so they can feel superior to you and comment on it.
Anonymously, of course. I realized I craved a simpler life, Kate said. For the first time in my life since I was a little girl, I could see things for what they were, and not just out of the corner of my eye as I was dashing from one place to the other. I could watch the sun come up in the morning and see it set at night. Then I could see a whole universe of stars so bright in the sky they almost hurt my eyes. I could smell things, flowers, sagebrush, pine trees, water. I could hear again without the background white noise of traffic and people. I read real books again, instead of watching video clips on my phone, she said. I started a journal, writing in longhand, with a pen. I do want to go back and get my journal. I left it in the cabin.
We're not going back for it, Sheridan said.
But I need it. I've kept it for me. I wanted to chart my own course on the voyage of self-discovery.
Self-discovery? You worried a lot of people. You're the most selfish human being I've ever met.
That's not fair, Kate said with a sniff that was no doubt painful. I don't owe anyone my presence in their lives, and I didn't ask anyone to search for me.
But that's what people do, Sheridan said. They help each other. Someone disappears, and of course they're going to look for her. You're such a pathetic narcissist, you can't even get that through your head. Why, even your sister came all the way here looking for you.
Clearly stung, Kate said, Sophie is a resentful and vindictive cow. She'll do anything to get attention, including playing the role of the grieving sister. I'm sure every little tearful speech she gave was covered by the press.
I don't know, Sheridan said.
You can count on it, Kate said.
What you don't realize is Sophie broke up my marriage and has moved in with Richard. The two of them are colluding to push me out of my own company. Now they can have it. She didn't come here to rescue me. She came here to confirm I was dead.
Sheridan had no response, but she now knew one reason for Kate's troubled expression when she thought about going back.
Sheridan took the exit to I-80. The highway was clear and dry, and she accelerated to 95 miles per hour. It was a straight shot to Rawlins and the hospital.
You're speeding, Kate said.
Let the highway patrol pull me over, Sheridan replied. Once they find out who's sitting beside me, they'll give me a police escort into town.
Kate shook her head ruefully.
Sheridan asked, How did you get Lance to let you stay in his cabin, anyway?
He pointed his cabin out to me when we were on a trail ride. He said he never locked it, which I found charming. So when I left the ranch after that week, I drove straight there without telling him. I was there for 2 weeks before he even found me, and when he did, I made him promise not to tell anyone. I'm sure he regrets that promise now, but he kept it. He's a very honorable man. He probably thought I'd stay at his cabin for a few days and then leave and go home. I might have thought about it then as well. But every week I found the prospect of returning more and more daunting. I don't think he even knew what he did for me, Kate continued. When he helped me up in the saddle or tipped his hat and called me ma'am, he just didn't know. Why would I ever trade long, lazy walks in the forest to going back to traffic, bad air, and insipid men without chests, to quote from a C.S. Lewis phrase I read recently?
Then she recited a line,
We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. In fact, Kate said, her voice wistful, I did try to leave once.
I drove all the way to Fort Collins in Colorado, toward the Denver airport, when I nearly had a mental breakdown. I just couldn't return to England. I just couldn't. I'd left everything behind that I'd come to care about. So I called Lance, and he drove down to pick me up. I left the car with the keys in it, and we both thought someone would report its discovery and I'd be forced to come clean. But apparently someone just stole it and drove it away. I'm sure Lance wishes he hadn't driven down to pick me up, but he's a rare gentleman.
He's an idiot, Sheridan said. He knew what an uproar you'd caused, and he still said nothing.
Yes, well, Kate said, it's not his fault. I was a little naughty. When he told me I had to leave, I said I'd tell the authorities he'd held me there against my will, that it would be his word against mine.
For once, Kate had the good grace to blush.
I wouldn't have done it, of course, but Lance didn't know that.
Which explained his growing anxiety and his reaction when he met her dad, Sheridan thought. What a bitch. Kate continued.
He didn't know what to do, and the longer I stayed, the more difficult it was for him. I could see it on his face when he showed up hoping I was no longer there. And I was there so long there was no way he could tell anyone about it.
She slid her eyes to Sheridan.
He loves you, you know.
Bullshit.
Oh, he does. It became a problem. We were never lovers. I know that's what you're worrying about. Sadly, it never worked out that way.
Sadly, Sheridan echoed bitterly under her breath. If he truly loved me, he would have told me he had a missing woman stashed away.
Really?
Kate asked.
Tell me, what would have been your reaction if Lance had told you a woman had been living in his cabin with his knowledge for months?
Sheridan didn't answer because Kate had a point. Kate chuckled at that and then turned serious again.
I don't think I can ever go back. Can you imagine the insurmountable wall of questions, the hateful comments on social media about where I've been and why? I just couldn't face it.
You have no idea how much trouble you've caused, Sheridan said. Now please quit talking so I can call my dad.
Lance really likes him, you know,
Kate said.
Shut up, Kate. I'm not as fascinated with all things Kate as you are.
As she fished her phone out of her snowmobile suit, she heard Lance moan in the back seat and saw in her mirror that he'd pushed himself painfully into a seated position. When he saw who was in the front, he said, "Oh, no. I think I'm in big trouble."
Chapter 31.
I'm going to the hospital to confirm it's her, Joe said to Mary Beth as he neared Rollins. The massive steel hulk of the Sinclair oil refinery dominated the southern view out his passenger window. In the frigid dusk, clouds of steam from the refinery hung above it in the shape of a mushroom cloud. The heater in his pickup couldn't keep up with the icy wind whistling into the cab from his damaged passenger door.
Joe, don't hurt that boy.
I can't promise that.
After talking with Sheridan and hearing the flat sadness in her tone, all he could think about was clubbing Lance Ramsey, whether he had a broken leg or not. Joe could endure humiliation of his own. The fact that he was still working the case was evidence of that. But his vision turned red when it came to the betrayal of one of his daughters.
I'm worried about our girl, Mary Beth said. She hasn't had many serious boyfriends. And now this.
She'll be okay, Joe said, having no idea at all if Sheridan would be okay. She's tough, like you.
and she solved the big mystery.
Does the governor know?
I haven't called him, Joe said. I wanted to make a positive identification first and send him a photo of Kate to back it up. We can't afford to make another mistake.
I'd like to see his face when he sees it. I wonder how he's going to spin it so he can take credit for finding her alive.
That's what Hanlon is for, Joe said.
He entered the hospital for the second time in 2 days, and the receptionist directed him to the surgical suite on the second floor. Joe took the stairs and found Sheridan, Mark Gordon, and Kate Shelford Longdon sitting in a Spartan lobby. Sheridan and Gordon sat on one side of the room, and Kate sat on the other. Sheridan looked up, and their eyes met for a moment before she turned away. She clamped her lips together to keep them from quivering. Kate acknowledged him with a curt nod. He said to Kate, "You've created a lot of problems around here for a lot of people, but I'm glad you're safe and alive."
"I was always safe and alive. Why can't people understand that?"
Sheridan shot a bitter look at Kate, and Gordon sighed audibly. Joe could feel the tension in the room. It was Silver Creek Ranch versus Kate Shelford Longdon. For her part, Kate seemed preternaturally disconnected from the situation, as if she were there by mistake. That rubbed Joe the wrong way. He held up his phone and said, "Smile for the camera." He got 2 clear shots before Kate looked away, annoyed. He attached both photos to a message and sent them to Governor Allen and Connor Hanlon with the tagline, "We found her, and she's in good shape."
"Lance is in surgery," Gordon said to Joe. "We talked to the surgeon, and his prognosis is good. They're worried about infection, but they said the cold temperatures probably worked in his favor."
Gordon reached over and put his hand on Sheridan's shoulder.
"Your daughter probably saved his life."
"Yeah, so that's on me," Sheridan said. "You did the right thing," Joe told her.
"Then why do I feel so crappy?"
"I did my best before she got there," Kate said defensively. "I don't have any formal training in treating injuries."
Joe ignored her as he approached Sheridan. His daughter stood up and he hugged her. She felt small again in his arms.
"Mark, I did my best," Kate said to the general manager. "I was trying to figure out how to get some help for Lance when she showed up. I would have gotten something sorted."
Gordon turned to Kate, and there was a long pause. He said,
"I suppose I shouldn't expect gratitude from you after all this time, but a lot of people risked their lives and their careers trying to find you. My property will forever be linked to a visitor's disappearance in the minds of potential guests, so you could at least shut up for a while."
"Oh, please."
Kate started to speak, and then obviously thought better of it, and closed her mouth. Joe took Sheridan aside and told her that he was meeting Nate at the Encampment Lumber Mill, and he'd be happy to give her a ride back.
"I'll stay," she said. "I guess I want to make sure he makes it through surgery."
Joe nodded. "So I can kill him," he added. Joe hugged her again. Before he left the room, he said to Kate, "You need to stay right here. I'm calling Sheriff Neal. He'll probably have his own ideas about what to do with you. You wasted a lot of state and federal resources, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if someone decided to slap you with a whopping bill and legal charges." She put on a defiant look, but she looked a little shaken.
"She doesn't care about anything or anyone but herself," Sheridan said to Joe. "She doesn't care how many people she's hurt on her voyage of self-discovery."
Joe wasn't entirely sure what his daughter meant, but he trusted her judgment.
"There's another reason I'm staying," Sheridan said to Joe softly, as she turned her back to Kate and showed him the screen of her phone.
She'd surreptitiously taken several photos of Kate at the cabin, in the cab of her pickup, and at the hospital. "These are going up on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram," Sheridan whispered. "They'll go viral within hours. Kate told me one of the things she dreaded most was the social media reaction. Well, now Kate's chickens will come home to roost." Joe gulped. "I want to be here to see it happen," Sheridan said with narrowed eyes.
Sheridan was tough, he thought, as his boots echoed in the long hallway away from the surgical suite. But she was hurt, and there was very little he or Marybeth could do about it, other than to be there for her. When the girls were young, he knew better how to deal with their problems and minor tragedies. He could distract them, or make pancakes for them, or offer to drive them into town for ice cream. He had little experience dealing with the problems of adult children. He wished Mary Beth were there, but perhaps Sheridan didn't. He raised his chin when a woman shouted from one of the hospital rooms ahead of him. She sounded angry. "Nurse," the woman called out, "I need to make a statement. Nurse!" A nurse brushed by Joe and walked quickly up the hallway toward the room with the disturbance. She said to Joe, "She just gained consciousness. I've told her to use her call button, but she'd rather yell." Joe followed and glanced over at the open doorway where the nurse had entered. The whiteboard next to the doorframe read, "Carol Schmidt." He paused. Schmidt was sitting up in bed. She peered around the nurse who was hovering over her, and she saw Joe in the hallway. "Are you a game warden?" she asked him.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Good. You'll do."
"You'll do."
Then, "I need to talk to somebody in law enforcement. I need to make a statement."
"You really need to calm down and get some rest," the nurse told Schmidt as she gently pushed her back toward her pillow. "It isn't good for you to get so worked up. I'll talk to the doctor about prescribing a sedative."
Joe recognized the name as the same woman he'd heard about at breakfast. He removed his hat and entered the room.
"A statement?"
he said.
The nurse gave up trying to get her to lie flat, and she stood helplessly to the side of Schmidt's bed.
"Galen Kessel ran me off the road," Carol Schmidt said. "I'll testify in court it was him. At first I couldn't remember his name when I saw him, but it came to me just this afternoon."
"Galen Kessel," Joe repeated.
"He's that windmill guy."
"I'm aware of him. Why would he do that?"
"I made some legitimate complaints about that burner at the mill in encampment, and I identified his truck being there. I even got the license plate number, and he knew it."
To the nurse, Joe said, "Keep her healthy. We'll need her on the stand." Sheriff Neal didn't pick up when Joe called him directly on his cell phone. Joe didn't want to call the sheriff's office itself with the news of either Kate's appearance or Schmidt's allegation, since Michael Williams thought Kessel had a mole or two within the agency. When it went to voicemail, Joe said, "Everything is broken open. Call me back." Then he sent the photos of Kate as well, thinking they would prompt Neal to drop everything he was doing and return the call. Joe roared down I-80 toward Walcott Junction and the road to Saratoga. It was dark enough now that the sea of red blinking lights from the Buckbrush Project pierced through the southern sky and cast the horizon in an unnatural neon hue. 1,000 wind turbines, he thought. A $5 billion facility. Whether operating on his own or under orders, somebody was out to protect that investment at all costs until it could go completely operational. That somebody, Joe believed, was Galen Kessel. And Nate was sure Kessel himself was making a delivery to the burner in encampment that very night. When Joe's phone lit up while he was making the exit off the interstate, he expected Neal to be on the other end,
But it wasn't the sheriff.
What the fuck are you doing? Hanlon shouted.
Joe had to move the phone away from his ear.
We found Kate, Joe said.
I saw the fucking photos, Hanlon screeched. Are you sure it's even her this time?
Yep.
Why are you even there? Why are you still working the case?
Joe said, I thought you'd be happy to know she's okay.
I'm happy, Hanlon screeched. But that has nothing to do with the fact that you've gone rogue over there. Don't you even know what you're fired means?
I guess not, Joe smiled.
It doesn't change a thing, Hanlon said.
If you thought this would buy your job back, you're even dumber than I thought you were.
Maybe I am, Joe said.
I'm going to send the highway patrol after you. I'm going to order them to pull you over and arrest you for impersonating a law enforcement officer.
Tell them to hurry,
Joe said.
Hanlon went silent for a moment.
Why?
Joe disconnected the call. Then he said to himself out loud, because after tonight, the governor's two biggest contributors are going to be real mad at him.
Hanlon called back immediately, and Joe let it ring.
Chapter 32 Nate was with Jeb Pryor and a sullen, overweight man who slumped in a hardback chair in Pryor's mill office. Joe had walked through the darkened and silent mill to get there. He stomped snow and sawdust from his boots as he entered the room.
Don't worry about making a mess, Pryor said. Where did you park?
Out front, Joe said.
I didn't see your vehicles.
We hid them behind the building, Pryor said, except for Wiley's pickup. That's the truck you saw down by the burner on your way in.
Joe nodded and assessed Wiley, who was apparently the sullen man. Wiley hugged himself in a way that suggested his ribs hurt. He had both ears, though. Joe shot Nate a look.
He's a no-account worm, Nate said. His only purpose on Earth right now is to receive a call from Galen Kessel.
That name again, Joe said. The room smelled of sawdust and pizza. The pizza box was on Pryor's desktop, along with a half-full bottle of Yukon Jack whiskey. They'd already eaten the pizza, and all that was left was grease-stained cardboard and a few discarded crusts.
We found her, Joe said. We found Kate.
Alive?
Nate asked.
Very much so.
She was hiding out at Lance Ramsey's cabin, and she'd been there the whole time. Actually, Sheridan found her and brought her in.
Sheridan?
Yep.
I'm not all that surprised about the Brit, Nate said. Too many people around here seem to think she just stayed. I think if you really look into it, you'll find that the Tubners sold her a little meth, and the Youngbergs probably spied on her.
Joe nodded. I really don't care about that woman anymore. She's someone else's problem. I'm more worried about my daughter.
You've got something else to be worried about,
Nate said as he held out his bald fist toward Joe.
We found this in the burner.
Joe opened his palm up, and Nate dropped a light metal object into it. It was an elongated ring nearly half an inch wide.
Recognize that?
Nate asked. Joe held it up to the light and turned it in his fingers. The soot had been largely rubbed off it, and he could make out some kind of insignia and a series of numbers.
It's a leg band, Joe said, the kind the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service use for research.
Research on golden and bald eagles in particular, Nate said.
They exchanged looks.
Nate said, maybe next time you'll listen when falconers start complaining.
They're always complaining, Joe said. They're like farmers or outfitters.
But this time, we had a point,
Nate said.
There was a reason why the feds wouldn't let us get eagles to hunt with. Too many of them were ending up in that burner down there.
What? Pryor boomed. Even Wiley Fry looked up. He was confused.
We've only got a couple of hours,
Nate said.
We need to make our plan.
Damn, Pryor mused. All along I thought that Kate woman ran off with the game warden.
That was your theory? Joe asked.
It was until now.
Some conspiracy theories are better than others, Nate said with a smirk.
Ted Panos slowly unthawed in the passenger seat of Galen Kessel's pickup as they drove south toward encampment. He was glad he'd popped Percocet before they went out that night to help numb him against the cold, but it was wearing off and Kessel kept looking over at him with suspicion.
Open your window, Kessel said.
What? Why? It's 15 below zero out there, Panos complained.
You've got fucking feathers stuck to your sleeve, moron.
Panos held his arms out in front of him and placed his fingertips on the dashboard. Kessel was right. There were a number of small pin feathers stuck to the fabric of his coveralls, as well as smears of blood.
Oh. Clean yourself off, Kessel said. Get those feathers off your arms and out of my cab.
As he said it, Kessel worked the master control on his side of the truck, and Panos's window rolled down. Panos winced against the cold while he frantically brushed at his sleeves to remove the feathers, which floated away behind them on the two-lane highway. When he was done, Panos shoved his frozen hands between his thighs and waited for Kessel to roll up the window. When he finally did, Kessel said,
"You smothered the wrong old lady last night."
Panos looked over, unsure of what he'd just heard.
"You killed some old broad named Alvarez who was in there with pneumonia. Don't you know the difference between a 69-year-old white lady and an 85-year-old Mexican?"
"That's impossible," Panos stammered, although she had looked older and smaller than he'd guessed. "I saw her name outside the room, Carol Schmidt."
"Carol Schmidt is alive and kicking," Kessel said. "My sources in the hospital confirmed it. But this Alvarez woman died last night. It's not considered a suspicious death because of her age, which is the only good thing to come out of this."
"I can't believe it," Panos said.
"When we get done tonight, we're going back," Kessel said. "This time, you're going to get it right."
Panos started to object when Kessel backhanded him hard across his mouth. Then his boss leaned over toward him with bulging eyes.
"You're fucking this up for me," Kessel hissed.
"You're threatening my livelihood and my freedom. No one does that and lives."
Panos shot a glance at the front windshield. The truck was wandering over the center line because Kessel was glaring at him.
"Do you understand what I'm saying?"
Kessel shouted.
"Yes, boss."
Kessel swung at him again, and Panos was ready for it and partially deflected the blow.
"No more fuck-ups," Kessel said. "And stop taking whatever drugs you're on. From now on, you operate clean. I saw you out there picking up those carcasses in my headlights. You were stumbling around."
"You could have helped me," Panos thought, but didn't say.
"No more fuck-ups," Panos echoed. "Please watch the road."
Kessel jerked on the wheel just in time to avoid clipping off his driver's side mirror on a delineator post on the wrong side of the highway. After he'd recovered and was once again in the correct lane, Kessel raised his phone to his mouth. When Wiley Fry answered, Kessel said,
"Are we clear?"
Then a moment later,
"Hit the bricks."
Encampment officer Jalen Spanks was parked on a side road 100 yards inside the town limits when he saw a set of oncoming headlights veer wildly on the highway. He'd been watching pornography on his phone and had nearly missed the display of careless driving. He quickly zipped up and returned to his home screen.
He looked at the time on his dashboard clock. 2:15 in the morning. No doubt the oncoming truck was being driven by a drunk who'd closed down the bars in Saratoga and was returning home. Joe was slowly freezing in the cab of his pickup because of the damaged passenger door. He'd jammed a few dozen balled-up citation forms into the gaps, but he could still feel the cold coming in. He was parked hard against a wedge of plowed snow on a residential street that gave him a good view of the glowing burner and the mill yard. His Remington Wingmaster 12-gauge shotgun was propped muzzle down on the floorboard. His phone was on his lap so he could instantly see a text from Nate. Joe noticed that Henlon had called him 7 times that night, and he smiled to himself. A text appeared from Nate. It read, "Get ready." At that moment, a call came in from Sheriff Neal. His voice sounded groggy.
"Jesus, I just saw what you sent me," he croaked. "I was out with the missus and had a few cocktails, and I forgot to look at my phone. Is Kate still at the hospital?"
"I don't know," Joe said quickly. "But forget about her for now and get to the encampment lumber mill. Bring guys you know you can trust."
"What the hell is going on?"
"I don't have time to explain," Joe said. He could see a wash of headlights on the road out in front of him from an approaching vehicle. "Believe me, and get here fast." He disconnected as the light-colored pickup with a camper shell he'd seen parked outside Pollock's house passed under a streetlight and turned toward the mill yard. Joe now recognized the Buckbrush logo on the driver's side door. He also noticed the license plate and saw that the last 3 digits were 600, just as Carol Schmidt had reported. What Joe didn't expect was the sudden blinding red and blue light bar of the Encampment Police Department SUV in hot pursuit of Galen Kessel's truck.
"What the hell?"
Kessel said as his rear-view mirror reflected a blast of light and a siren whooped right behind him.
"Oh, no,"
Panos moaned. He pressed his hands to his face. Kessel slowed to a stop. The burner glowed 50 yards ahead of them. Panos could see that idiot Fry walking away from the burner to the mill building.
"Get out and see what that stupid cop wants,"
Kessel ordered.
"Why me?" Panos asked. "What if he wants to look in the back?"
"Let him," Kessel said. "Now go."
Panos was confused, but he opened his door and jumped out.
"Remain in your vehicle," the cop shouted. He was stepping out of his SUV as he did so.
"What's the problem, officer?"
Panos asked while he forced a smile.
"I said remain in your vehicle."
The cop was adamant, and as he gave the command, he reached back and gripped his weapon on his hip. Panos noticed that another set of headlights had flashed on across the road, and a third vehicle was coming fast.
"We don't want no trouble," Panos said to the cop.
"Hey," the cop said as he approached the truck. "Are you guys with Buckbrush?"
Before Panos could respond, there was a heavy boom and a flash from the other side of the truck. The cop dropped without even stumbling, and his arms flung out to the side.
"Get in or I'm leaving you here,"
Kessel shouted at Panos. Kessel lowered the Bushmaster XM-15 rifle he kept behind the seat for finishing off wounded birds. Then he suddenly raised it again and squeezed off 5 rounds at the pickup that was roaring at them from the dark.
"No!"
Panos shouted, but the gunfire drowned out his plea. Joe saw it all. The guy coming out of the passenger side of the company pickup, the officer ordering him to get back in, the driver hurtling out and firing from behind his open door, the cop going down. Then Kessel raising the muzzle toward him. There wasn't time to stop or veer away, so Joe threw himself on the passenger seat as rounds snapped through his windshield and out the back window. Slivers of glass coated him, and he was thrown to the floor when his truck crashed into the back of the stationary patrol SUV. Panos broke into a run just as the green Ford pickup slammed into the encampment cop's car. The collision was hard enough that the cop car lurched forward and nearly crushed the downed man. He didn't know where he was running, only that it was away from the mill and away from Kessel. His heavy coveralls didn't help, and he gasped for air. It was so cold that his lungs burned. Then he heard footfalls behind him. Kessel? No. A game warden in a cowboy hat. Joe almost threw the shotgun aside but decided against it as he chased the man who'd run from the scene. When he'd rolled out of the cab, the man was running away right in front of him, the glow from the burner on the back of his coveralls. It was only after 50 feet that Joe realized he wasn't chasing the shooter but the passenger of the truck. He glanced over his shoulder as he ran, hoping Kessel wasn't drawing a bead on him. Kessel was moving as well, loping up toward the burner with a rifle swinging in his hand. He didn't know that Nate was in the burner shack. Stop! Joe wheezed at Panos. But it wasn't really necessary. Panos had run across the packed snow of the mill yard and was now foundering knee-deep in powder. It slowed him down like a fly lighting on flypaper. Joe launched into him and both men went down. Joe flailed and managed to get on top, and he covered the tip of Panos's nose with the muzzle of his shotgun. "Roll over and put your hands on top of your head," Joe said. He was out of breath from running, and his knees ached from banging them on the floorboards in the crash. He didn't realize until that moment that he had a head wound as well. Blood ran from his chin into the snow and speckled it bright red.
"I might smother in the snow," Panos wheezed back.
"You might," Joe said. Panos grunted as he rolled to his belly. Joe straddled him and located the cuffs on his belt. They were so cold the steel stung his fingers. Joe patted the man down and found a .45 Derringer in his boot top. He pocketed the gun, then snapped the cuffs tightly on Panos's wrists. Kessel was reaching for the door handle of the burner shack when Nate stepped around the side of the structure and thumbed back the hammer of his .454. He stood with his back to the open door of the burner so his form was silhouetted against the flames. The sharp, metallic click cut through the roar of the fire in the burner. The sound made Kessel hesitate and look over. When he did, Nate pointed the weapon at the man's left eye. The reflection of the flames danced in that eye.
"Toss your rifle away," Nate said just loudly enough to be heard over the fire.
Kessel froze in place.
"Or you can go for it," Nate said. "I really hope you do."
Kessel straightened up and let the rifle drop to the snow. He said,
"I think we can try and work this out. My employers have unlimited funds."
"Of course they do,"
Nate said. He pointed to Kessel's vehicle.
"What's in the back?"
"That's not important. You're obviously not a cop. What will it take to let me drive out of here?"
"No, I'm not a cop,"
Nate said.
"I'm a master falconer."
The realization of what Nate said dawned on Kessel's face.
"So this is about those damn birds?"
Kessel said.
"I trade one of them for 10 of you."
Nate stepped back and gestured for Kessel to return to the site of the crash. He said,
"I have a friend named Joe who would like to meet you."
Kessel rolled his eyes and said,
"If this is just about birds, we can work this out."
The man passed between Nate and the open doorway of the burner as he said it. Nate waited for mid-stride when Kessel was off balance before reaching out and shoving him inside. It was quick. Kessel screamed and thrashed for a few seconds, but he couldn't regain his footing. Then his body went still.
One of Kessel's boots remained outside the doorway, and Nate kicked it into the flames as well.
There was the strong odor of roast pork in the air.
Joe marched Panos toward the vehicles and confirmed that Officer Spanks was deceased from a bullet through his heart. He had likely died before he hit the ground.
"It was Kessel,"
Panos said through chattering teeth. "I saw it all," Joe said. "Then, were you there when Steve Pollock's files were taken?"
"Sort of,"
Panos confessed. "What happened to the shooter?" Joe asked Nate after he'd guided Panos toward the burner shack. Nate had met them halfway.
"He fell into the burner."
"He fell?"
"Tripped on his own feet."
Joe took a deep breath and chose not to ask more. Indicating Panos, Joe said, "I'm going to put this guy in the burner shack until the sheriff gets here."
Nate nodded.
"I'll wait out here. But we need to check out the cargo."
Nate reached up and grasped the handle of the camper shell on Kessel's pickup. He turned it and the hatch rose slowly in the cold air. Joe flipped on his mag light and shone the beam inside. The back was full to the top of the bed walls with dead eagles and eagle parts. The carcasses had been piled on a thick sheet of plastic that would also, he guessed, have been thrown into the burner.
"Damn them,"
Nate said.
"Yep. I wonder how many overall."
"Maybe Ted Panos can help us with that," Joe said.
It took nearly an hour for the small convoy of Carbon County Sheriff's vehicles to arrive. Sheriff Neal and his team started securing the mill yard and taping off access with yellow crime scene tape, despite Jeb Pryor's protests that he had a business to run. Panos was transferred to a sheriff's department vehicle, and Spank's body was transported to the Carbon County Hospital. Joe leaned inside the patrol SUV.
"Please close the door," Panos pleaded. "I'm freezing here."
"Tell me what you know about Kate Shelford Longden."
"I don't know much. Galen thought she was out there somewhere screwing a young cowboy."
"Did he tell you this?"
"Yes. I don't know how he knew that, though. We even spent some time trying to find her, but we couldn't."
"Why?" Joe asked, puzzled.
"Because Galen didn't like the attention her case brought to the valley. He said it attracted too many cops and reporters."
Joe nodded. It made sense. "Did he tell you about her a couple of months ago in the rustic bar?" Panos shrugged.
"Yeah, that's probably when it was."
Joe leaned back and closed the door. Panos stared straight ahead as if viewing the coming attractions of the rest of his life, starting with a long stint in the Wyoming State Penitentiary in nearby Rawlins. Joe waited in Pryor's office to give his statement to Neal. Now that the adrenaline of the events had ebbed, he felt immensely tired and sad. Sad for the encampment cop, sad for Sheridan, sad for the Eagles, sad for himself. Nate had slipped away. He was good at that. Outside the room in the mill itself, he heard Sheriff Neal say,
"Where do you think you're going?"
When the door opened, a Wyoming state trooper filled it. He was beefy and his cheeks were flushed from the cold.
"Are you Joe Pickett?" the trooper asked.
"Yep."
"I've been instructed to bring you in."
Sheriff Neal shouldered his way into the room and turned on the trooper.
"This man stays," he said. "I need a statement out of him. In case you haven't heard, a cop was shot here last night."
"I heard," the trooper said, "but the command came from the governor himself." Joe watched out the side backseat window of the highway patrol cruiser as encampment, then Saratoga, passed by. He was numb. "I need to give my wife a call to let her know I'm all right," he said to the trooper.
When we get to where we're going, the trooper answered.
Am I under arrest?
The highway patrolman grunted.
I don't know what you are.
Joe drifted away and watched as dawn began to paint the east side of Elk Mountain in the distance. He paid no attention when the trooper took a call on his phone in the front seat.
It's for you, the trooper said as he passed his phone through the slider to Joe.
For me?
Yes, sir.
Joe raised the phone to his ear.
I talked with Mary Beth,
former Governor Spencer Roulon said.
I hear you might need a lawyer.
Joe smiled.
I think I do.
The End. This book was read for you by David Chandler, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Disappeared, a Joe Pickett novel by C.J. Box. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.